So are there any questions? I guess the lights aren't working, are they? Right, well, like you can have, you know how when the conditions are present, then something will, you'll have a certain perception of something or a memory, and then you start thinking about it. You know, as you, it'll stimulate the kind of habitual pattern of thinking, of liking, disliking, or if it's an unpleasant feeling, then we have these defense patterns where we just tend to ignore or suppress. Have you ever had, you just like, you noticed any of these deja vu kind of experiences where suddenly you think, I've been here before. Or this, because sometimes the light is a certain way and it'll bring back a memory. Or, I mean, they're quite subtle, you know, some of it is just, like yesterday coming home, we went to a petrol station. I just saw a kind of something on the garage that reminded me of something that happened years ago. You know, just where the place and the petrol station had nothing to do with the actual event, but it was more like an atmosphere or a feeling. Yeah, and then you tend to proliferate on it, you know, or you call pressing the buttons, or somebody will say a word and or give you a look, and then we're so sensitive, we feel all these different things, the way somebody looks at us or doesn't look at us, or a tone of voice or a word will trigger off various emotions. Because that's like this, it's a budgetless sense of condition arising. When the conditions are here, then this is the result. And of course, we have a retentive memory. So these memories are triggered off through when the conditions for this particular memory, for any memory that are present, then you remember it. Well, we can't control the impression or the contact, because that just happens. As we're more mindful, we can either think about it or not. As we're more mindful, then we're not just caught in reacting to it. But at first, you know, I found in myself I didn't have that much mindfulness, so I had to catch myself in the middle of something. You know, because I wasn't that aware to be able to not get caught, not grasp it. But as you develop more awareness and it connects more and more, then you feel things or you hear or whatever, but your awareness is such that it's embracing it, so that you don't. I mean, if you want to think about it or not, you have a choice. Well, at first it seems like you don't, because we tend to be so kind of conditioned, caught in the conditioning. But as you begin to let go of that, then it's the same, we're all the same. See, that's like with meditation, you're actually learning, understanding how your mind works more and more, so you're not just a kind of helplessly, you know, victim of your habits. You have a way of resolving things and letting go and not attaching. Like I noticed, like say something like some strong emotion like anger. It used to be if something happened and I'd get angry, then I'd be aware suddenly I was angry and I might have already, you know, said something or that, but and then as I became more aware, and then I could feel, so when something happened I could feel the anger rising, but I wouldn't grasp it. So like you can still feel angry, but you're as you're mindful, you're less prone to grasp the anger. So then this kind of disempowers that habit, and it starts fading away. It becomes less and less because you're not feeding it. And repressing anger is still feeding anger. You know, like the more you try to make yourself not angry, and by just denying and suppressing, then the more angry you get. Yes. Well, this is where you know it's important to make your intention very clear. What is your intention? What I mean is that we can say in monastic life, my intention is to be free from delusion, which doesn't mean that I'm always free from delusion, but that's my intention, and that intention is quite rational. I've chosen it. You know, it's not a kind of emotional high or from an inspired kind of over the top feeling. It's quite cool and deliberate. So, and that's my intention for this life. And so, like for you, to clarify your intention for what you're doing. You know, so and make your intention beautiful. You know, you don't have to, you know, it can be, you know, to produce programs or television programs on spirituality that will really benefit others, you know, and make it quite unselfish as an intention, because you can choose on that level, and then that is that's your intention. Then when the realities of your life, like the way you are as a person, your own character tendencies and habits, and then the world that you have to operate in and work in, recognize, more or less accept it for what it is, you know, so that you know, if you can you know, if they're not making you, forcing you to do things that you shouldn't be doing, or you know, going along with things that are not right. But if it's just the workplace problems and the competitiveness and the jealousies and the crankiness of society, then you know, just with that, just do the best you can. But your intention, then trust in your intention. And even when emotionally you might mistrust yourself, you know, you think, well, maybe I'm just being, you start doubting, and just don't, you know, you've chosen, you've made your intention, and trust that, and then you can be more aware of maybe your own emotional reactivity to the situation you're in. It's just, it's like this, you know, rather than your intention. Mm-hmm. Then develop a louder voice and take up karate, maybe. Learn to trust, really. Well, I mean, you know, it's not something I can make you do, but, you know, I encourage you to trust it, because that's really the only thing you can trust. And even though it, you know, you're emotionally, you might feel, oh, I kind of, you know, don't believe that. You know, your emotions are conditioned, and they'll bring up all kinds of doubts or self-doubts and confusion, but trust in that awareness of it, you know, so that you'll find your strengths in that, and an increasing sense of stability within the storms that go on around you. That's why I encourage this trusting, because I found in my own life that's what gives me strength to bear with the changing conditions that I experience, and then it gives me a sense, and it works, because you can pretty soon you feel quite fearless, because you realize you're the trust is giving you feeling a sense of real centeredness and a strength coming from within that isn't just going to be ripped away from you by the next storm, next event. But it's an intuitive sense rather than the intention can be quite rational, but then the trusting is an intuitive. And keep reminding yourself of it, because, you know, in your emotionally, we don't trust it. You know, emotions, how can I trust that? And we just get caught up in doubt. And doubt is the real, you know, it's through thinking about it and being going back into the wheel of should, shouldn't, or is this true or false? Am I being silly or stupid or am I being honest, or an endless production of doubts and about yourself, about your profession, about everything. And so this is the challenge for all of us, you know, for every single one of us, is learning to trust in this, and to trust it. We have to put it to the test, and to come from that place more and more, and not worry, not make too much a problem about all the furores of the. Of the marketplace. Well, you can do both. But also those things, you know, all of us have been affected by mass media in some way, you know, that has helped us, and just like you know, in I mean, some of it's, you know, just like the back in the '50s, and just a silly kind of fad of beat Zen in the San Francisco, you know, and it was very superficial and very short lived, But even on its most superficial level, it awakened many of us. You know, and suddenly it was brought to our attention something that really changed our direction for our lives. And yet, in itself, one could criticize it and put it down as frivolous. Or, you know, even like I remember Alan Watts was teaching in San Francisco at the time, and the Way of Zen had become quite a bestseller, and he was a very charismatic person, you know, and very wonderful speaker, and so his books were his books were quite readable, and then later on he kind of, you know, degenerated and all kinds of gossip and scandals surrounded the life of Alan Watts, and then one tended to you know, I could see the judgmental side of myself kind of putting him down, but then I remembered, you know, at one time his book Way of Zen was very important, you know, it had helped me a lot, and whether it was the great book on Buddhism of the age. It wasn't, but it was certainly enough to help and to direct at that time. And with television or these kind of things, sometimes these people have seen. I remember there was a television program years ago, 20 years ago or so, I think, made by the BBC on Buddhism in Sri Lanka, and it was quite nicely done, and they showed this monk walking meditation, you know, walking back and forth in meditation, and I don't know how many people were so impressed by that, just that image, you know, just that particular image seemed to resonate with so many people, just the sense of composing and doing something quite deliberate and mindfully. So, you know, this is where, you know, if you judge your own work, your critical faculty will probably take over. So sometimes you can't, you know, you don't trust your own reaction to what you do, you know, because, I mean, for me, I'm the worst critic of myself. people tell me how much my books have helped them, and how much they appreciate the books I've written. But every time I read my own books, I start getting critical of them. I have trouble reading my own stuff. I don't have to listen to them. Yes? Well, reincarnation is usually that's more to deal with the speculative thing of previous life and this life and the next life of a physical rebirth. And then there's various theories of, remember, you know, being with a group of theosophists in Australia who were saying no matter what, you couldn't go backward. You know, if you were born a human being in this life, you couldn't go and be reborn as a frog again. And they were insistent. I said, you don't, nobody knows this, do they? You know, maybe, you know, that's a great hope. but actually, I mean, I don't know, you know, and it's something you can't prove. But then Ajahn Chah was very much used the term rebirth. Because this is about the present moment, like the paradigm of awareness, and if you're not aware, then you tend to keep being reborn again all the time, like on a level of your mental state. So like if you're a totally heedless person, then you just get caught up in things, and you don't have any moment of kind of awareness. You just operate kind of through habit patterns and reactivity, and so you're constantly in this is what they call a constant cycle of rebirth. You're always in this cycle of changing, and where when you stop, when you're aware, when you awaken, then you begin to see yourself creating yourself in all these different patterns as a person, and you begin to when you see the suffering you create through doing that, you let go of those habits, and you begin to rest and trust in this awareness, which is what we say deathless, or it's unconditioned. So the soul is, you know, when you think of what is it that gets reborn all the time, is like desire, really. Desire has this, it's our soul, actually. And it's, the desire to become, or desire to get rid of, and so when we're constantly lost in these desires, we have this sense of always, desire to be, you have a desire to be. If you don't like the way you are now, then you desire to be different somehow, to become better than what you are now. Or if you want to get rid of the bad things that you don't like, have a desire to get rid of your bad habits, and then you have a desire for pleasure and happiness and things like this. So this, like in the Buddha's teaching, is to understand desire, you know, really studying and recognizing desire, rather than trying to destroy it and kill off desire, because that's a desire, you know, it's an annihilationist desire, is to get rid of desire, but to understand desire. That which understands desire is not desire, you see. So then you're beginning to understand that the Buddha is pointing to a reality that transcends this birth-death cycle. And that's what Nibbana is where you awaken and realize the deathless reality, rather than the conditioned that you identify with, like you, your body, the sense of yourself as a person, your identities, and all that. So rebirth is the word they use in the scriptures, like in the dependent origination, paticca samuppada, and so forth. And these words are pointing to a reality that we can actually witness to, where reincarnation is speculative. It's interesting. But yeah, well, like deja vu or things like this. Who knows how it all operates? I don't know, but there are kind of moments where you remember things or remember being somewhere where or you've never been there before, or what they are. In terms of whether previous life, that I don't know myself, but some people can remember previous lives, but that's still memory, So I remember, yesterday. I remember, certain things that happened to me from childhood. So I mean, these are memories of previous lives, actually, that come up when suddenly I'll remember something when I was a teenager, or whatever, and it'll come up into consciousness. Now, whether I haven't had any previous life memories, so but a memory is a memory. We're looking at it in terms of Dhamma, you see, rather than in terms of the uniqueness of the memory. So if I remember being Napoleon or something, that would be a unique memory, but it'd still be a memory. And it would come and go, That's what, like in Vipassana, you're noticing the way things are rather than the quality of them. Like remembering a previous life, I was Napoleon. That would be a very outstanding memory. That would be almost fantastic. You probably wouldn't believe me if I told you. But if I said I remember yesterday at Leicester Summer School, then Maggie Roshan would say, "We remember that." That'd be just kind of ordinary memory. But whether it's ordinary or fantastic or special, that's not the point. The thing is that the memory is impermanent, and this is where, like Ajahn Chah was very much, because Thai people tend to also, they want these kind of, previous life or special signs they want magic or kind of fantastic experiences. And Ajahn Chah was always, saying, don't, even if it's fantastic, it's still impermanent, so. Just see the changingness of things rather than get dazzled by the kind of quality that they present, or dismiss things because they seem insignificant or banal, because we can get very, we think, so that's not important, but this is really important, really get caught in what we think is silly and stupid. I'm not going to bother with that, but this is very important, how we choose. But in terms of awareness, the quality is not the issue, whether it's silly, stupid, or very important. We're noticing that it's changing this. That gives us a perspective, and it doesn't diminish the quality in any way, but it gives us perspective on the quality. Like, if we don't have that, then we tend to get overwhelmed by the interesting stuff, and we can just dismiss, can't be bothered with that trivial, foolish stuff. So we have a way of kind of dismissing as kind of an arrogant attitude we can develop. I'm only, I'm so important that I can only deal with the really important issues. The silly stuff, can't be bothered with, I'm beyond it. And it's kind of like an arrogant When I do that, you know, I see that as kind of an arrogance that comes in. I'm so good that the trivial side of life I give no attention to and don't. I can't learn from that. It's too insignificant. I can only learn from the best. Well, some people, you know, they get into this. They want the best teacher. Well, Dalai Lama probably. But some of us have learned, you know, from, you know, I learned from Alan Watts or from, you know, I remember learning from monks in Thailand. You know, Ajahn Chah was very kind of highly regarded. But I've also learned from very insignificant monks or teachers that, you know, no one has ever heard of. And it's not that. It's not how important or the best, but how open you are and how willing you are to learn from even not very good teachers. So I remember Ajahn Sajito, when he came, you know, he was with a teacher in Thailand who was an English monk. And this English monk I'd met, and I didn't think very highly of this monk, actually. And I thought he was on an ego trip, so I'd completely dismissed this monk. And then I remember when Ajahn Sajito came to England and he joined the community, I was impressed by how willing he was, Ajahn Sajito was willing to learn from a monk who I felt wasn't, you know, who I wouldn't have bothered with. But yet he could learn from him. You know, and that, you know, then I saw how, you know, kind of a kind of arrogant tendency I have. And I've appreciated the kind of willingness of somebody like Ajahn Sajito to learn from somebody that wasn't at all considered the best and was oftentimes highly criticized. But what he learned was, you know, he learned because he was open. He developed, you know, a lot of awareness and understanding just through his attitude rather than feeling dependent upon, you know, the best teacher in Thailand or whatever. Yes? Well, like celibacy is, you have to choose it, you know, it doesn't, if it's forced, it's easily goes into suppression, but it's a mirror for, I mean, because you still have these energies, and so you, but your relationship to them is through awareness, rather than through acting on them, And so that this I know because I've lived a celibate life. The tantric practice, I don't know anything. I wouldn't know, you know, about that. But mindfulness is the whole purpose of both. And you know, so I can only speak from a celibate position. But it does, you know, it does simplify life being celibate, And it also, you're, it's not a suppressive thing that you're doing. You're not, you're not denying or rejecting, but you're really you're very much aware of the of these sexual energies. That I mean, you can't escape that, because that's just the body is like this. But then the celibate vow is to not act on it in any intentional way. But you're certainly aware of it, and then you're aware of its presence and absence. So then, as a community, also a celibate community, especially in a community like this, where you've got men and women living together in the same monastery, or monks and nuns, but the agreed way of living is through celibacy. And so this doesn't mean that we don't ever feel any of these kind of desires or these energies, but we're not acting on them or following them. Oh yeah. Well, like the lower part of the body is a powerhouse of energy, because you've got the reproductive organs, the digestive organs, all these are, you know, this is, down here is a real it's a real place of power, and the people that live very heedless lives, like just promiscuous and have no control, then their energy is always being, you know, going out through the sexual organs and through the lower parts. And so, but like celibacy does give you this sense of you're developing this energy. So it's rising up, and you're feeling this sense of this energy is highly regarded, and it's precious. So it fills you out. It gives you presence, gives you awareness. So it's not like, but if you're suppressing, you know, out of fear and aversion, then that still keeps the energy down, you know, in the lower level. And that's why if celibate people who've only suppressed sexuality eventually can't keep it anymore, because it's just too much to bear if you're just kind of, you know, willfully resisting it. But if you're raising it and developing it, then it leads to enlightenment. Yeah, and it's because you're getting beyond the male-female identities, you know, the female body or male body, and you're transcending your identity with that, you know. So like these, it moves about getting in touch with your inner feminine and your inner male and all that kind of thing. I mean, this is, you know, New Age kind of jargon, but it does have a point in the fact that the forces are, you know, complementary, and like masculinity as an identity leads towards aggressiveness and rigidity and where femininity, without the balance of masculinity leads towards nebulousness, softness, amorphousness, kind of emotionalism. Where when they like the yin yang, when they complement each other, then that's a whole, that's perfect. So I mean, but there isn't like, I mean, we it's like the feminine isn't like I have to find a feminine person. I mean, a female person. But I find that myself, I'm, you know, the kind of where you know you're strongly identified with being male, and as a cultural conditioning, at least I was very strongly identified with that. And then as you let go of that identity, more and more the softer qualities, the kinder, the more expansive and gentle qualities are there. It's not like they're not in you know, I have to go and try to find them from somebody else, but it's learning to open to that, because we're, you know, our true nature is neither male or female. It's the perfect complementariness of those two that we begin to respect, rather than identify. We don't identify with being androgynous or, you know, sexless or anything. That's another identity again. Or the Buddha, you know, if you're castrated, you can't become a bhikkhu. You know, like a eunuch, you can't, you know, because you need this energy. You know, it's important for the holy life. The what they call a sexual energy. Yes? Well, I can only speculate about him, but I think, you know, something when we're, you know, our lives have, like, it's like a war hero or something, you know, somebody in a battle saves the lives of his battalion single-handedly, and that can be a peak experience. That he'll, and the rest of his life is meaningless after that. You know, so it's like that. The holding on to the peak experience doesn't diminish it, doesn't diminish the you know, but then it becomes a memory, and so then we hold to the memory. Then the movement of our life can only be nothing as good as that. So this is where the mindfulness practices are to bring attention to the ordinary. Rather than always trying to practice in order to have a peak experience. So it's like you know, for yourself, not to just holding on to the memory of a peak experience. Remember, it's only a memory now. And so you'll find you're more connected with the flow of life, even when it's quite ordinary or even banal or mediocre. I mean, it is what it is. And more you find this awareness as a natural state that allows for conditions to change, but you no longer hunger after peak experiences through remembering the ones you've had. Does that answer your question? This is an important one because, I mean, we all do that. Like I had the first year when I was a samana, I had so many peak experiences, kind of blissful states and glaring, kind of blazing insights. Just seemed like I understood everything, and you know, I thought I was enlightened, really. You know, it was so fantastic a year, and I suffered a lot. You know, went through a lot of basic loneliness and misery and obsessive thoughts and whatnot. But through all that, as I kind of bore with everything, then I started having kind of very powerful insights. Well, then the next year I took higher ordination, went off to stay with Ajahn Chah, and I kept wanting to have those experiences again because I remembered. And my first year as a bhikkhu with Ajahn Chah was pretty, you know, just kind of wasn't having any of those. Just learning the Vinaya, the discipline, and then you had to work and you had to do all these things, fit into a community, and it all seemed so dreary in what I remembered the first year. So the second year I managed to get away and went off to the mountains to have more peak experiences, and was a disaster because I was very attached to, because I remembered these peak experiences. Then I had the insight, though. I realized that now I just have the memory. When I had those experiences, I didn't have any memory of them. They happened spontaneously because I wasn't seeking them. They just happened because I didn't know what I was. You know, I hadn't had them before, so that it was like they happened, and then that was it. Then once they happened, then I would remember them, and that'd create this desire. So I'd be practicing with this desire to have these blissful experiences again. And I realized I had to let go of that. And this was quite powerful insight also, and Lungpa Cha's attitude was ordinariness. He's always emphasizing the ordinary rather than the getting the high samadhis and having the magical powers and reading minds and being special. He would poo-poo all that. He'd just say, "Don't bother with any of that," you know, and just keep us focused on just the kind of ordinariness of monastic life. You know, putting on your robe and eating your food and just the most kind of things that you do all day that you don't think are terribly important or interesting. And so this is where I began to realize the wisdom in that, rather than this goal-oriented style that was kind of, you know, because I'm brought up in a society that's very goal-oriented, you know, always trying to, you know, this restless energy, always trying to get some, live up to some standard or get something, some special thing. And also my ego is one that I never wanted to be ordinary. I always saw myself as special. The idea of being an ordinary person I didn't like. I always wanted to be special, you know, a unique person or special person. So the idea of just being an ordinary guy.
<That's fun.
But then in the monastic life, you know, the whole becoming a being a monk was just learning to be kind of ordinary in within the monastic system rather than a star. And it's interesting to see, especially with Western monks, sometimes you know, it happens a lot in Thailand where they try to become, you know, kind of star monks and outstanding, because that's our nature. And then we tend to look down on the Thai monks. They don't even try like me. I've given up. I was a property millionaire, and I was a film star, and I've given it all up to dedicate my life to the Dhamma. And these guys, they are just rice farmers, peasants. You can get, you know, this kind of supercilious arrogance and take yourself very seriously. But one thing I've had problem, because I fulfilled all my unique wishes, because, you know, I was kind of a star also in the Thai for a while in Thailand, and you know, all the attention and whatnot. But then I saw how that those kind of situations, I didn't realize the suffering and attaching to that in identifying with being special, always thinking of myself as a special case. And so you could see how much misery and unhappiness you create through those attachments. So more and more you just keep learning as you go along of just letting go of ambition, desire to be special or see yourself as in any way as being a special, unique, gifted monk or spiritual being or something like this. There's a kind of arrogance among people in the spiritual world. I think we're spiritually gifted, and we can look down on those that seem very worldly. And that can be a kind of arrogance. So these identities are, you know, whatever they are, we're witnessing them and seeing that attachment to these identities is the cause of suffering. Or to see some monks or nuns going to, I don't want to be special, I just want to be ordinary. And so then they're determining to be specially ordinary. That's a kind of catch-22. The only way to deal with it is to transcend it. Sila are standards to guide us, and if we don't have any standards, then we tend to not know what to do, because things, you know, what feels good might seem to be right. It feels so good, it must be right, or something like this, that we're easily influenced by a kind of special feeling or an excitement or a pleasure or or what others say. So that this is that if we have no bound, no commitment, then to some kind of moral basis, it's easily just to get, you know, lost in the endless things that happen and have nothing to refer to except just people's views and opinions. And so that's what I found in just like the sila as a, I mean, I lived a while just in this kind of hedonistic style, and before I was a monk, and the result was just a tremendous kind of confusion and self-aversion, where, you know, I just didn't know where I was, and it just seemed to be so kind of blown about by different conditions, and so I didn't have, I felt a lot of self-aversion and emotional confusion from that. And yet it promised a lot, this kind of bohemian lifestyle where you just feel and do and experience life and love everything, and it sounded, you know, wonderful. But then the actual result of it, it wasn't very good for me. Then the monastic life gave me something to reflect on, and the thing I really value about Buddhist sense of morality is that it's very clear that it's around action and speech. It's not about thought or feeling. So where my sense of morality came from, the thing that one rebels against in the Western world, when you rebel against morality, it's usually because it's been presented as a commandment that even a bad thought is immoral. Or, you know, remember when President Carter said he had actually looked at another woman with lust, and this was immoral, you know, admitted that he'd actually done this immoral act. And he hadn't done anything, but he just looked. And so this is why we get so guilty, because we're aiming too high. You know, we think, you know, we feel guilty because we might think immoral thoughts or feel like doing immoral acts, and then we start hating ourselves because we feel like we're immoral for doing that. But then in the Buddhist sense, it's down on, not on level of thought or emotion, but on speech and action. Well, that you have some choice in the matter in terms of that. Where the other, you don't have all that much choice. Things happen, you know, so you know, conditions arise, so you feel like this. It may not be how you want to feel, but this is what you're feeling, whether it's moral or immoral, right or wrong. It's like this, and if you're idealistic about morality, then you can only feel very guilty and worthless if your thoughts are low and you're feeling selfish and even you want to kill somebody. You feel terrible that you should feel so much anger and resentment. You'd want to murder anybody. And start fearing and hating and worrying about yourself. But in terms of the reference to sila, then this allows us, this gives us a practical standard of restraint on the level of action and speech. And then in terms of meditation, we can be aware of what we do feel. You know, you can be totally honest and accepting of your emotions and your thoughts, memories, tendencies, and not judge them in terms of right and wrong, but see them in terms of rising, ceasing. But then in terms of action and speech, then we act on what is good and refrain from acting on what is bad. So this is the general advice, to do good and refrain from doing evil. Then of course, when it comes, you know, then the special situations arise. You know, what, like for You know, people would ask, if you're a Buddhist monk and you saw a maniac come in to the room and attack your mother, what would you do if it was a Buddhist monk? Because we're not supposed to hit anybody or kill anybody. This is a moral dilemma. You know, what would I do if this happened? And then of course this is speculation. I don't know, but I know that if those conditions came together, I know I would know what to do. You see what I mean? If I'm holding to the fact that a Buddhist monk can never hit or harm anything, then should I just let this maniac brutalize my mother because I'm keeping to the rule? Or, you know, that's like I'm holding to the rule and as an ideal and not trusting in a wisdom that arises in this moment. And so this is where this awareness and this sati sampajanya and that is the way of liberation, not just keeping, you know, moral precepts, but in actual developing wisdom, so that if such conditions arose, I would trust in the right thing to do, whatever that would be. And then, of course, in any situation, we're talking about something that is impossible, because my mother's dead. So she, you know, there's no possibility of that ever happening in my life. But then if she were, you know, there are other things like if, you know, there's other things that we wouldn't imagine. Like what if my mother was a karate expert? What would I do if my mother attacked a maniac? Then it gets absurd. Or what if the chandelier fell on top of the maniac just as he's about to touch my mother, and this crystal chandelier fell on his head and knocked him out? Or what if the sheriff came in the door? You know, so I mean, these are all speculations, but they're valid, just as any, you know, what would you do if a maniac attacked your mother? But training yourself in this way, then more and more I trust in the special contingencies and conditions that arise, that I trust that it would be an act of spontaneity rather than a breaking of a rule, whatever, you know. And so this is I think this is very important, because we tend to see, you know, like the Western mind, that's why there's so much rebelliousness against morality, because it's like when they talk about Victorian morality, or this kind of, your God punishes you for breaking the moral commandments. And so it's you have this sense, you know, culturally we feel very threatened all the time, like we're going to be punished if we're bad and rewarded for being good. So there's this reward and punishment conditioning that our culture gives us. And then with Buddha Dhamma, you're actually awakening, so that you're not just keeping moral precepts because you're afraid of breaking them and being punished, but your sense of morality is something coming from wisdom and seeing the value of it, and to treasure it rather than to grasp moral precepts and then try to make yourself conform because you're afraid of being punished if you don't keep them. Right. Yeah, but then in terms of the lifestyle, if I, you know, people watch me, so I live within the confines of the monastic form, but I no longer feel bound by it, you know, my relationship has changed with it, so that it's not like I'm holding on to it, but it is like, I remember one time Ajahn Chah was saying to me, he said, I could touch money now, I could have money, it wouldn't be any great defilement for me, but you know why I don't? I said, why? He said, because of you. He said, if I had money, then you think you could have money. But these are the dilemmas of monastic life, you know, for monks and nuns. It's because we're really learning a skill that we wouldn't learn any other way. But it does seem almost like kind of conflicting. Like Lungpa Cha would say, Dhamma is letting go and freedom, and Vinaya is all holding on. He says, you probably wonder how to deal with this dilemma, you know, because you're saying Dhamma is, you know, everything and letting go, and then Vinaya is all these picky little rules and prohibitions and things like this, and way etiquette, manners and so forth. And one takes attachment, the other is non-attachment. But then it's more like a training, allowing. It's like learning a musical instrument. You train yourself through really, you know, doing repetitive exercises and developing skill with the violin, and then being able to play kind of according to the what's on the page. And you have to keep, making yourself do these rather boring exercises, repetitions over and over, till eventually you can forget it, you know, because it becomes a natural way of doing something. So then variations on the theme and creativity can come into it. But it's like the restraint of Vinaya. Is gives us that it's a like learning a particular style, a lifestyle that then once you've learned that it has its we don't have to kind of keep doing it, you know, as an exercise endlessly, but as it becomes quite natural to the way we do things or respond to life. But then in situations. Special situations, you know, like in living in Thailand and living here. In Thailand, you're living in a Buddhist society, and so you've got Thailand is 95% Theravadan Buddhists. At least they all think of themselves as that. So I mean, there's a homogeneity there that you don't have here, and then there's a culture. And Buddhism is within the cultural, you know, it permeates the cultural attitudes and expectations and assumptions that people have there. So the whole system kind of flows quite naturally. The monastic life, the monastery, the bhikkhu, the society, the structure of the society, the king and all the rest. It kind of it works because it's so everything is really embraced by the attitude of Buddhism, and so it's easy to just live and keep and be kind of the perfect monk in Thailand because the conditions allow that. And then when you're coming to live in say Western country like here, you can't expect that because it's not Buddhist, and it, and we're oddballs in the society. We're freaks. We're, you know, people don't know what to do with us. People, you know, the society doesn't, you know, we're strange, and the reactions are different. So then we can, then we adapt here. You know, we can't expect the same kind of treatment that you get in Thailand. So we have to trust much more intuitively and be sensitive to the culture that we're living in, to the people, to the conditions. And so Ajahn Chah was always emphasizing to know time and place, to be aware. Like when he came to London in 1977, I remember, or 1979, his second time, I remember him doing things that were quite, he would never do in Thailand. And but he would see a situation, like one particular one is I remember, like when you receive food and that, you're not supposed to say anything. So if somebody gives you food, you're not supposed to say thank you, or I really like your food, or that was really delicious, you know, or things like this. You're supposed to, the ideal in Thailand is they offer food and they don't want to be rewarded for it. You receive it, and that receiving it is enough, and anything extra is kind of, you know, not proper, not right. So, but in this country, you know, you receive the food and you don't say anything, people misunderstand. So then they think we're arrogant, you know, we receive the food and we walk on. And it looks like to a European, like we're very ungrateful, and it can look like we're very ungrateful and arrogant. So I noticed that one time this woman was prided herself on being a very good vegetarian cook. So she invited us to her house for a special meal, and we walked in the door, and she was a nervous wreck. She had this incredible spread of the most fantastic looking food on the table, you know, and marvelous kind of pies and crusty dishes and all kinds of things. And she obviously put enormous attention and probably didn't get any sleep the night before. And she was very nervous about it all. So we came in, and then I noticed, like, Lungpa Cha's whole emphasis was helping her to relax. Like, he'd be much more kind of friendly than he would tend to be. Or he'd say, "Oh, your food's really good, you know, I really like this." And, you know, you could see that he was giving up the Vinaya rule, because it didn't apply there, and he was more sensitive to the needs of the woman. That he was trying to get her to enjoy the goodness she was doing. Or she wouldn't have understood the other. She would have thought we didn't like the food. Well, you see, this is where he used satipanya, or mindfulness wisdom, rather than just keeping to the letter of the rule. And this is where he was picking up on the, you know, out of compassion, he saw this person didn't understand, you know, the how to do it, and that she was doing her best, and that he wanted her to enjoy what she was doing. See, that was kind, that was compassion. But then my mind said, he shouldn't be complimenting, you know. It's breaking a rule. Yeah, he was very, that's one thing I think what his outstanding quality was. He was so skillful with people and being able to respond to you know, All kinds, even foreigners, even people who couldn't understand, or he couldn't understand on the verbal level, he had a very kind of sense for how to respond to somebody. And this impressed me a lot, because in Thailand I just took it for granted, but when I came to England with him, I was wondering how he was going to cope with the Europeans. Because in Thailand, people are crawling on the floor and doing this and running around and doing everything for him. And I thought, they're not going to do that in England. No way. I wonder how he'll feel when they don't do this. But he seemed so at ease, and open, and wasn't put off by things that would have been considered rude if that had happened in Thailand. I remember just before we came to England in 77, we went on I went on an alms round with him to the nearest village, and there were a lot of other Thai monks, and a lot of the monks were worried about Ajahn Chah coming to Europe because they thought, nobody knows what to do, and they won't treat him properly, he won't be respected, and there's all this kind of fidgeting and worry going around. And so coming back from the alms round, they were saying, I don't think you should go because, it'll be, what if they, do something they shouldn't and they won't respect you and you won't be properly treated and I don't think you should go. And they're going on like this. And so one of the things in Thailand with a monk is if you touch their heads, that's the biggest insult, You're not supposed to touch a monk's head, go like this, or anybody's head really. Especially a monk, if you go like this, that is, don't ever do that. So then Ajahn Chah says, he says to these monks, in England, he said, if their way of greeting me and showing me respect is to go like this, he says, that's fine, I'll accept that. And the monks go, oh my God. Well, when Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip went to the States about 15 years ago or so. Remember, the Americans, you see, they don't know how to deal with royalty. So they want to bring everybody down to kind of a familiar level. So they had big signs saying, "Welcome, Liz and Phil." I think that's enough.